we have never authorized detention of a citizen in this country without giving him an opportunity to be heard, to say, hey, I am an innocent person. He hasn't even been able to say that yet.
That was Frank Dunham, made on April 28th in the Supreme Court. Yasser Hamdi, the so-called American enemy combatant, currently detained in the United States, was recently granted due process rights by that court.
The way you get the best information from individuals is that you interrogate them, you try to develop a relationship of trust.
Associate Solicitor General Paul Clemente's answer, trust us, essentially saying we don't do torture.
It is trust us. And who's saying trust us? The executive branch.
CBS Television televised the photos of Abu Ghraib, indicating that you can't trust the government. You need courts to look at what the government is doing. The government had asked CBS to hold up the photographs of Abu Ghraib for 2 weeks. April 20th and April 28th were the 2 weeks when three critical cases were argued in the court concerning enemy combatants, the Guantanamo cases, and two American combatant cases, Hamdi and Padilla. It's in those 2 weeks that CBS did not publish those photographs. Yet 8 hours after Paul Clemente said, trust us, those photographs came out. Amazing.
Welcome to a special edition of Law and Disorder on recent Supreme Court decisions affecting the so-called War on Terror. I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Michael Ratner, President of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Stephen Smith, author and New York City attorney. Our fourth host, Dalia Hashad from the ACLU, is on assignment in California. The great civil liberties attorney, Bill Kunstler, saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th. At a certain point, it'll be irreversible.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four attorneys and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. We'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope we'll be lawyers you will like.
Today on Law and Disorder, we're going to discuss some of the major Supreme Court cases that have given a real blow to the administration's so-called war on terror. Three of those decisions concerned so-called enemy combatants: the Guantanamo case, the case of Jose Padilla, and the case of Yasser Hamdi. In the Guantanamo case, which was decided on June 28th, the Supreme Court held that non-citizens detained by the United States in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, could have access to American courts for testing the legality of their detentions. Prior to this decision, the lower courts had held that no non-citizen held by the United States in Guantanamo or anywhere else in the world could open the American courthouse door and test their legality of their detention through a writ of habeas corpus. A writ of habeas corpus is a legal proceeding that allows you to force the United States to determine whether or not you are legally held. In a stunning decision, the Supreme Court said 6-3 that aliens, non-citizens held in Guantanamo in the so-called war on terror, could have access to American courts. Hear about that case and more about what the lawyers in that case plan to do next on the rest of this program. Two other cases concern American citizen enemy combatants. The case of the so-called dirty bomber, Jose Padilla, picked up in Chicago, eventually sent to a military brig without attorneys' access to him, and again litigated in front of the courts. In the Supreme Court, in the Jose Padilla case, they held that it had been filed in the wrong court. Jose Padilla will get rights, will get the right to contest his designation as an enemy combatant. And in the third of those cases, the case of Yasser Hamdi, again an American citizen, but this time, unlike Padilla, picked up in Afghanistan, the U.S. tried to, by affidavit, say that he was enemy combatant, didn't give him any chance to contest that affidavit. The Supreme Court says he has a right to a meaningful opportunity to contest that affidavit. And Justice O'Connor, who wrote that opinion, gave a very narrow view about what was an enemy combatant, someone who had to essentially be fighting against the United States. Taken together, those three decisions really were a major blow against the draconian cutbacks on civil rights and civil liberties and international law that has characterized this administration's war on terror. Those three cases will be discussed today, along with two others. The fourth case that we will talk about is the Alien Tort Claims Act case.
The Alien Tort Claims Act case was a very important case because it upheld the right of non-citizens to use American courts, for example, to sue American corporations that are involved in murder and torture. What's the relevance? It's relevance to the torture issue that's going on now in Abu Ghraib and in Guantanamo, and gives access to the victims there to use American courts for redress.
We'll also take a look at a recently filed lawsuit against two United States corporations, Titan and Khaki, that provide contractual military service overseas. The case specifically deals with the corporation's failure to adequately train personnel and supervise their actions. Joining us now from Minneapolis is civil rights attorney Joe Margulis. Joe was cooperating attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights and a key litigator in the Guantanamo cases.
Hi, Joe. It's Michael Smith. First of all, congratulations. The Guantanamo victory was just a tremendous thing. Tell us, what was at stake in Guantanamo in that lawsuit?
Well, immediately for our clients, there were 14 left in the case. Two were released in the course of litigation. What was at stake for them was the prospect of an indefinite future in isolation, in this lawless void that no light could enter. But more broadly, we know the names of our clients almost by accident. There are hundreds of people there who are unknown to the world. The United States knows who they are, but has not disclosed them. What it meant for those people is that they will not be held in a prison beyond the law, and that eventually, we hope soon, there'll be a robust process to determine what, if anything, they have done wrong.
Well, as I understand it, in pre-Bush days, in fact, going all the way back hundreds of years, you couldn't just be thrown away in a dark hole and the key lost. That if you're picked up, you got a right to know what you've been picked up for. You got a right to see your family. You got a right to see your lawyer. And you got a right to contest whatever the beef is. Isn't that true?
Yeah. I mean, that's what habeas has always been. That's what is at stake. Habeas is one of the most time-honored and hoary of the protections of individual liberty. It is one of the only protections of individual liberty that's enshrined in the Constitution, as opposed to the protections that were added later in the Bill of Rights. It is the classic check on arbitrary executive detention, the idea that if the executive locks you up, you have a right to go to a court through counsel and say, look, what did I do that justifies this detention? And if the executive is not in a position to come forward with evidence to justify it, then you have a right to your release.
Joe, some of our listeners may not be familiar with the term habeas. You're talking about habeas corpus, the Latin term literally mean bring forth the body.
That's right, and I apologize. I hate it when lawyers slip into jargon, but that's it. It's an ancient common law right to get access to the body of a prisoner who's otherwise held in incommunicado detention.
And due process here just means you got to be fair.
The essential principles of due process, which is what we've been arguing about from the outset, don't say that you can't hold people. What it says is that you can't hold people without what everyone would consider fundamental fairness, and that is notice and an opportunity to be heard in a timely fashion before an impartial tribunal.
And are there other examples that you can maybe share with our listeners about when habeas corpus has been successful, you know, in death penalty cases?
Well, as it's developed in the present day, there are two kinds of habeas. One is post-conviction. So it's a person who's gone through a trial, been convicted, sentenced to a term of years or sentenced to die, and he brings a habeas action. And it is habeas that has secured the release of over 100 death row inmates from around the country in the modern death penalty era. If it weren't for habeas, many of those people would have been executed. This case is a slightly different one it raises a different kind of habeas. What do you do if the person hasn't been convicted at all? In fact, they've never been charged. They're just held without any process. That's what was going on. That's what's still going on at Guantanamo. This was habeas in order to start a process. So in that respect, it's really more fundamental.
So you brought the habeas petition, and you lost, and you appealed, and you lost again. Isn't that right?
Yeah,
and it was only till you got to the Supreme Court that you finally won.
That's correct.
Did you think you were going to win?
Absolutely. People don't believe me when I say this, but I never, maybe because I'm naive, but I never thought that the United States judiciary would allow for the creation of a prison beyond the law. I never believed that. And the lesson of history in times of in other periods of crisis is that initially there is a reluctance on the part of the judiciary to question the executive. They give the executive broad authority. But eventually, not without notable exceptions, and the Japanese internment cases are notable exceptions, eventually the judiciary's back will stiffen. And what the administration was seeking to do in this case was so extreme, so unprecedented, that I always believed that once we got to the Supreme Court would strike down the initiatives that the Bush administration was proposing.
Joe, what's going to happen next?
Well, now it is a matter of implementing the victory. What it means immediately for our clients is that we've already started the process of getting them access to the court hearing that they're entitled to. The government is not opposing our request to get access to our clients. You know, mind you, our clients don't even know this litigation has gone on. It's the only case that I'm aware of in U.S. history where people who are the subject of litigation in the United States Supreme Court aren't even aware of that fact. And we're going to, in the coming days, I hope, get an opportunity to go down and finally meet with our clients and check in on their welfare and ascertain whether they've been treated properly. And we are going forward with similar actions on behalf of other detainees, some of which were filed this week, or rather last week, and we anticipate others being filed this week. So what we will gradually do, as quickly as we can process the demands, bring actions on behalf of the other people there so that no one is deprived of the benefit of the decision.
Joe, you helped beat back the police state, and you're saving our reputation. We thank you very much for your good work, and thanks for being on the show.
Thank
you,
Joe.
Not at all, guys. Take care.
So long.
We've just heard from Joe Margulis, cooperating attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights in the Guantanamo cases.
Next, we'll hear from Donna Newman, one of the lawyers for Jose Padilla, a case that was just decided in the Supreme Court. Jose Padilla is the so-called dirty bomber who was arrested or captured, whatever word you want to use, in Chicago a couple of years ago, taken to New York as a material witness, then eventually pulled from there by the Department of Justice and put into a brig in South Carolina, where he was denied access to an attorney and only was allowed to challenge his confinement in a district court in which the government simply put in a third-person affidavit, hearsay, that said what he was, but Donna Newman, his lawyer, was not really allowed to challenge that at all or bring any witnesses. She lost the case in the district court. In the circuit court, she won on the grounds that no U.S. citizen could be held without explicit authority from Congress under the Anti-Detention Act, Section 4001, that was passed after the Japanese concentration camp cases to prevent American citizens from being held without the explicit authority of Congress. So she won that in the courts in New York, in the highest court in New York State, the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. The case then went to the Supreme Court, and in a 5-4 decision, that court ducked the issue, saying that Donna Newman had filed the case in the wrong court, and she should have filed the case in South Carolina, where Mr. Padilla is currently in a military brig. At the same time as they ducked the issue, they did indicate in the other case, the Hamdi case, and conceivably in this case as well, there was some indication in Padilla that if and when that case finally goes to the merits, that it will be decided that Jose Padilla must have a special statute of Congress passed if he is to be detained on the vague way he has been detained. Donna, so I haven't seen or spoken with you since the to four Supreme Court decision in the Padilla case.
Right.
Well, what'd you think?
Well, they certainly dodged the ball on Padilla with respect to hitting the nail on the head, except to say that if you read the Padilla case along with the Hamdi case, it's very clear that five justices, with respect to the merits, agreed with the Padilla position.
Now, what was the Padilla position?
The Padilla position is that the executive is not above the rule of law, does not have the authority unilaterally to detain an American citizen seized on American soil indefinitely.
And that's under that special statute, I forgot, what is it called, 4001?
Yes, 18 U.S.C. 4001A, which provides that no U.S. citizen may be held without a charge.
How long has Padilla been held?
Over 2 years now, and no charge. So that certainly it's a clear violation of a United States law.
So this American citizen was picked up in the United States, held for 2 years, not allowed to see his family or a lawyer, not told what the charges were against him, salted away somewhere. The case goes up to the Supreme Court, and 2 weeks ago the Supreme Court says you're in the wrong place?
Well, essentially they say you're in the wrong place, but if, as I said, if you read the opinion, you get the distinct impression, or it's very clear, that when you do get to the right place, however, this is where the judge should find.
Now, what have you done since the decision has come down?
Mr. Padilla has filed his petition in South Carolina. He did that Friday.
And that's where he's in a military brig, right?
That is correct.
Has any attorney had a chance to speak with him?
Yes, we went down. Mr. Patel and myself, who's my co-counsel, went down. We spoke with him. We advised him of the Supreme Court decision, and he signed the petition.
Donna, was that a private conversation? Because I know your last conversation was that you had before the Supreme Court argument was videotaped or something?
Yes, we did. We were allowed to have a private conversation. However, there's certain things that are very important. One, our ability to go down and see Mr. Padilla is still under the Department of Defense's position that it's discretionary, at their discretion. Number two, we still cannot take notes because whatever our client says is considered classified. And because of that, our notes would have to go directly to the Department of Defense for their review.
That's incredible. That means that when you get into court, you have to essentially remember everything he's told you for contesting or cross-examining?
Essentially, yes. And so, thank God I have a good memory, but it's certainly going to be tested.
I'll say
but
that.
It's important to understand when you say when we get into court for cross-examination, it's still important to that we do not have a charge. He is not being charged with a crime, so there will not be a trial. However, under the Hamdi decision, the Supreme Court said that Mr. Hamdi, and therefore Mr. Padilla, must get some sort of hearing.
You know, arguably, Donna, when I looked at those decisions myself, and Hamdi, I think Justice O'Connor, who wrote the opinion, was fairly narrow in terms of the definition of enemy combatant as someone picked up in Afghanistan. And in that case, I read as they may not have to charge him with a crime. But in Padilla's case, because he's picked up in the United States in civilian clothes, et cetera, it's arguable that he may get much more than Hamdi gets.
And that is our position. We know what the minimum is, but he's certainly not the same as Hamdi. And I believe that Justice O'Connor's opinion, which so was narrowly drawn and very specific, you did have the impression, even with Justice O'Connor, that she was excluding Padilla.
That's what I got the same impression, that it really, she said, this is about a conflict with the United States, about Afghanistan, and when's the war over with Afghanistan. And and in that case, he's a similar, really, analogous to a prisoner of war in an ongoing war, whereas Padilla is not, and the argument would be if he's so-called an alleged terrorist, then he shouldn't be treated the same way, but treated under our criminal law system.
So, Donna, what's at stake here for the average American citizen in the Padilla case?
Well, I think it's very important for people to recognize that if the executive has the power that he claims, that anybody can be picked up, because anybody can be alleged under a very ambiguous definition of being an enemy combatant. So I think that Justice O'Connor saw that, and that's why she, you know, narrowly defined it. It's important for people to recognize that it's not just Mr. Padilla. No matter what anybody's allegations, we have certainly tried people who have been alleged and, in fact, convicted of some very terrible crimes. For our country to remain strong, our Constitution must be adhered to. And that's what the issue was in the Padilla case. And I feel very confident now that we, in fact, have made the kind of law that Mr. Padilla can be successful in South Carolina.
Now, Don, are you still under a gag order of sorts?
Well, anything that Mr. Padilla said, as I said, is classified. To that extent, yes. And also with respect to the kind of information that I can ask Mr. Padilla about. Again, going back to the restrictions, not only is it at their discretion, but the topics of conversation are likewise at their discretion, that there are certain things I cannot talk to Mr. Padilla about. And one of the areas which is of particular interest now is interrogation.
The type of interrogation he underwent?
Correct.
Including the methods they used?
Correct.
Which you're not, you may know about from him, but you're not allowed to speak about, is that right?
No, I can't ask him.
You can't even ask him the question of what happened to him?
That's right.
Incredible.
And here's a guy who's being charged with being a dirty bomber.
Yes, yeah, so I'm very quick about the dirty bomber thing. As you recall, while they hyped that up and said that all over, now we learn when Mr. Comey, James Comey, made his statement on June 1st that they knew when they had detained Mr. Padilla from the start that, in fact, there was no dirty bomb plan.
What was also remarkable about that statement, I thought, Donna, which really gets to your gag order, is I guess a couple of months ago when James Comey went forward with a statement really essentially giving up the dirty bomb theory, but instead talking about gas in apartments or something like that, they went public with essentially an indictment of your client, not an indictment, but a public indictment.
Right, a public indictment.
Right, and you weren't allowed to respond to it at all.
Correct, because I still have my agreement with the government that there are certain things that I cannot say, so I can't and I won't, because I abide by the rule of law. If I sign an agreement, I will abide by it.
Now, Donna, are you allowed to talk about what condition he's in, what shape he's in, how he's feeling?
Yes, and I can say that, you know, physically he looks fine, but we all know that anybody that's held in solitary confinement is not mentally fine. I am not a psychologist. He would have to go through testing, and I would have to be able to talk to him at length about various topics to get to the bottom of that. And, you know, those are some of the things I cannot talk about.
Well, okay. Donna, thank you very much. And really, we'll keep in touch with you as you fight on in the Fourth Circuit now in South Carolina.
Right, when we get up there. Thank you very much, and thanks for this opportunity.
Yeah,
thanks Donna.
Good
work and good luck to you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
That was New York criminal defense attorney Donna Newman taking on what's got to be the hardest case in the country, a man that's been accused widely of being the dirty bomber, salted away, given no lawyer, not allowed to talk to anybody, finally gets a lawyer to see, and his lawyer is told you can't tell anybody what he tells you.
And now we're going to hear from Jeremy Kamens, a public defender who, along with Frank Dunham, represented Yasser Hamdi in the Supreme Court of the United States in a case called Hamdi v. Rumsfeld. Hamdi is the American citizen, so-called enemy combatant, who allegedly was picked up in Afghanistan, brought to the United States, held in a brig in South Carolina, where Frank Dunham and Jeremy Kamens were appointed to represent him. They, of course, never got to meet with him until only the Supreme Court had decided to hear the appeal in the case. And now we'll be happy to hear from Jeremy Kamens.
Hi, Michael. How are you?
Good. How are you guys feeling about the Supreme Court case in Hamdi?
We're extraordinarily pleased with the decision. We're very happy about the opportunity to go back and tell our side of the story.
What did the court say in that case?
Well, it was a very divided court, but four members of the court, in a decision written by Justice O'Connor, found that Congress has the power to authorize the detention of U.S. citizens as enemy combatants. However, the government can't just decide that what they say is the law, and it has to go back to court so that the citizen has a chance to rebut what the government says about them.
Now, if four justices decide that, there's nine on the court, so how do they get a majority with only four?
Well, that's a good question. It's a decision written by a plurality, which it means that it's less than a majority. Maybe I can just go through the decisions one by one and describe how the court broke down. As I mentioned, the four justices agreed that the government could detain American citizens as enemy combatants, but said that the Due Process Clause requires them to have to have a chance to go into court and rebut what the government says. Two justices, that is, Justice Souter and Justice Ginsburg, wrote that Congress may have that power, but they haven't done it here, and that in order to authorize detention of American citizens, Congress has to say so explicitly. Two justices, and that's Justice Scalia and Justice Stevens, and they represent kind of the poles on the court, Justice Scalia on the right and Justice Stevens on the left, wrote that the Constitution prohibits the government from detaining an American citizen unless you charge him with a crime and go through the normal criminal process. So they felt that under the history of our country, the Constitution basically says there's only one way to detain an American citizen under these circumstances. Justice Thomas wrote a sole dissenting opinion in which he agreed with the government completely, and that is that whatever the government says goes, and they get the final word on who's an enemy combatant. Now, fortunately, eight justices on the court rejected the government's position in this case, that the government gets to decide who and when and what an enemy combatant is, and nobody else gets any other chance to rebut what they say.
So in the end, we're left with the majority really saying that Hamdi, who was picked up in Afghanistan, should get a meaningful opportunity to contest the basis for his detention, and that should be before some kind of neutral decision maker. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. That's specifically what Justice O'Connor wrote in the plurality. And one interesting thing about the decision is that throughout the litigation, nobody has really come up with a definition of what an enemy combatant is. And Justice O'Connor, in her plurality, described a pretty limited and narrow definition of what that is. She said that the government must show, in a hearing before a neutral decision maker, that Hamdi was part of or supporting forces hostile to the United States or coalition partners in Afghanistan, and that he was engaged in an armed conflict against the United States. And I'll tell you what, that's something that I think the government is going to have a very difficult time establishing, because, you know, not even what they've said up to date suggests that Hamdi was, in fact, someone who was fighting against the United States.
Yeah, no, I thought that was remarkable, and we were really excited about that in the other cases, particularly both in Guantanamo and in the Padilla case, because it was a very narrow definition of enemy combatant, really leaving it to people who've actually picked up arms as part of another armed force that the U.S. is fighting with, really closer to the definition of really a war than any alleged terrorist could be treated as an enemy combatant. So I thought the O'Connor opinion may be very helpful. It may not, in the end, it may not be limited to that, but right now I think it's very positive.
That's right, and it's going to be interesting. I guess one of the things that people reading the opinion have been thinking about is how is this going to affect people in the future? How is this going to be applied? And it may be that these decisions are going to be applied to basically require the government to abide by international law in the way that they have in the past. That is that the Supreme Court was not overly willing to adopt some kind of third and newfound position of the government that they can just decide what they want to do and when they want to do it in a war, that they have to abide by the law.
Right. As I recall, the government said something about him being, he was picked up by the Northern Alliance. Is that right?
Actually, I think that the government has said that Mr. Hamdi was captured by the Northern Alliance and that he was affiliated with a Taliban unit, and that when he was surrendered to the Northern Alliance, he had an AK-47, and that sometime thereafter he was handed over to U.S. military.
So it may be that he never fought against the United States or anything like that.
That's absolutely correct.
Well, Jeremy, is there any sort of final lesson we want to take from this case and what happened in the Supreme Court in terms of what it means for American citizens?
Well, Michael, I think that what this opinion says is that the Supreme Court is not going to stand by while the executive branch and the president engages in actions that are clearly violative of the Constitution. Even in wartime, the president must be governed by law, and that's exactly what the Supreme Court said.
Well, thank you, Jeremy, and congratulate your office and Frank as well. It was a great victory.
Thanks very much, Michael.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And you've been listening to Jeremy Kamens, public defender who, along with Frank Dunham, has represented Yasser Hamdi and represented him in the current case that was decided by the Supreme Court on June 28th of this year. We'll be right back.
Now, for a special feature of Law and Disorder, we have our own Michael Ratner and Ellen Ray in the studio to talk about their new books, hot off the press, Guantanamo, What the World Should Know. Welcome to the studio, Ellen. Michael, hello again.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Michael.
Heidi, I wondered whether you could tell our listeners a little bit about Ellen before we get into the interview.
Ellen Ray is president of the Institute for Media Analysis and author and editor of numerous books and magazines on U.S. intelligence and international politics. She's co-editor with William Schapp of the book Bioterror, Manufacturing Wars, The American Way, and also Covert Action, The Root of Terrorism.
Ellen, let me ask you this. I understand that you got this book out right away, and the way you did it was interviewing Michael about Guantanamo. What do you think, in a nutshell, is the most important thing about Guantanamo?
Well, I think the most important thing is that it's real accessible to non-lawyers. One can pick it up and read it and understand something about this mysterious place, Guantanamo, that very few journalists, even journalists, weren't allowed to go till recently.
Well, what's going on down there? Guantanamo is part of Cuba, isn't it?
Guantanamo Bay is a base at the far eastern part of Cuba. After the U.S. Interfered in the Spanish-Cuban War, allegedly on the side of the Cubans, to free them from Spain, the U.S., of course, went in and took over Cuba, forced the Constitution on them, and forced them to sign a very strong lease that basically gives the U.S., the United States, complete jurisdiction and control of about a 45-square-mile area, including the port at Guantanamo. And that lease is in perpetuity. They get approximately, the Cubans, about $4,000 equivalent every year in U.S. dollars, which they don't cash. Right. The Cuban government has refused. So basically, it's a U.S. military base.
It was supposed to be a coaling station, but it's not a coaling station. What is it? It's never been a coaling station.
No. It was a coaling station for a short while, Michael. Yeah. They needed coal and ships. But once they had oil, they didn't use coal. So then it became a U.S. military base to project U.S. military power. In 1991, the Center for Constitutional Rights and myself represented the Haitian refugees who were housed there from 91 to 93, Haitian refugees, HIV camp that we successfully closed. And, of course, now it is, as Ellen said, it's offshore concentration camp of the U.S. empire.
Even more, it's an interrogation camp. It's a way of practicing new interrogation techniques.
Well, who do they have there, and what are they doing to them?
Right now, there's around 600 people there. They're Muslim and Arabs, most men, some children. They're from all over the world. The majority, at least a while ago, were picked up in Afghanistan. But now they're picking up people everywhere in the world, civilians, people who were fighters with the Taliban.
Over 45 countries are represented.
Well, do those people have a right to a lawyer once they get picked up and shipped down there?
Nope. We don't even know their names, many of them.
Well, wasn't the Center for Constitutional Rights trying to intervene in that situation?
Well, we did, and we're going to talk about that lawsuit. But the book really describes, first of all, some of the history of Guantanamo. It describes what the U.S. is doing there, particularly focusing on interrogation techniques that have come out. Two of the English clients, Razul and Iqbal, who also wound up in the Supreme Court case, were eventually freed. I interviewed them in England with regard to the interrogation techniques, and we described some of that, everything from stripping to dogs to chain to the floor, pretty heavy stuff that really 3 months ago I interviewed them before the Abu Ghraib Iraq stuff came out, and I can't say I was skeptical, but it certainly seemed to me very strong stuff. And when I saw the Abu Ghraib torture stuff come out, I realized that these guys had described to me totally accurately what Guantanamo was, which is an interrogation camp, as Ellen has said, totally unauthorized, totally illegal, totally beyond the law. It's a no man's land in which the U.S. basically has claimed for a long time that no law applies at all.
What's also important about Guantanamo is that the commander of Guantanamo, General Miller, was the one who went to Abu Ghraib and gave them all the techniques to interrogate the prisoners, and that became known as Gitmoizing.
Right. In fact, General Miller was in charge of Guantanamo when a lot of these interrogation techniques were used. In November of 2003, in August of 2003, he was sent to, as Ellen said, to Iraq where he helped them use these techniques there. It's immediately, of course, after he leaves Iraq, after setting up, as Ellen says, Gitmoizing Iraq, that the Abu Ghraib pictures begin to come out in October, November, when they're taken, or shortly after Miller leaves. Miller was also, just as an aside here, he was also the general at Guantanamo, the man in charge of the camp, who decided to prosecute Captain Yi, the Muslim chaplain accused of espionage, then later found, of course, had to have nothing to do with espionage, then accused of pornography, then eventually even that charge was gotten rid of by people above General Miller. In an incredible act of chutzpah, the U.S. then, after all this has happened, after Abu Ghraib has come out, after Guantanamo has come out, decides to send General Miller permanently to be head of the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. I mean, it's unimaginable to me, but in this war on terror so far, everything the United States has done is unimaginable.
Yeah, well, next you'll know President Bush will be giving the guy a medal.
Ellen and Michael, I have a question. The book has a pretty impressive list of documents included in the appendices. What kind of sources did you draw on and include while writing the book? There are letters I see from two detainees who were recently released from Guantanamo.
Yes, those were Michael's clients.
Right. The letter is a letter that Iqbal and Razul wrote to President Bush as well as to members of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. It describes what happened to them in Guantanamo, because what happened is after the pictures from Abu Ghraib came out, people said, well, at least this didn't happen in Guantanamo. And they then wrote a letter saying, don't believe what you're reading in the press. Those pictures that you saw, what you saw in Iraq is what we underwent and what others underwent in Guantanamo. So that's one of the documents. Another document is the famous document that began the leaks around torture from the high administration officials. That's the document from the president's counsel, Alberto Gonzalez, to the president. That's an extraordinary document that alone people should just read that, because what it does is remarkable. It says, look, we don't want to apply the Geneva Conventions to the people at Guantanamo, because if we apply the Geneva Conventions and we then are accused of abusing prisoners or humiliating prisoners, we can be charged with war crimes under the U.S. statute. So the best way for us to avoid war crimes prosecutions, if some future prosecutor in the United States decides to go after us, is simply say the Geneva Conventions don't apply, and then we won't be guilty of war crimes. So that means that back in January 2002, when they were first putting people in Guantanamo, they were already contemplating using abusive tactics against the people in Guantanamo.
And that's the man that is rumored to be the next appointee to the United States Supreme Court, isn't it?
Well, Alberto Gonzalez is Hispanic. He was considered to be a possibility for the Supreme Court. I would say that his chances are out the window. On the other hand, a couple of the other memos were written by people, one by a guy who's now, I think, in the Ninth Circuit, some of these infamous memos. He actually made it to a judgeship. And another person, Haynes, has been suggested for one of the circuit courts. He's not been confirmed yet, but he was also the author of some of these infamous memos.
And another person is a professor of law at the University of California,
it's
right?
It's interesting how the Bush administration hides behind right-wing minority people and uses them to justify what they're doing.
You think there's any chance that these people have complaints made about them to the bar associations and maybe institute disbarment procedures?
I have heard that there are people contemplating or at least thinking about whether or not you could make complaints about what they've done, because what they've done is they've really disregarded, in my view, the fundamental laws of the United States and of the world. And given two interpretations that are remarkable, the first one, which we talk about in this book, is that the president is exempted from the prohibition on torture. That as commander-in-chief fighting a war against terror, he can torture people for purposes of getting information. That's what I call the Pinochet defense. You can imagine, that's what Pinochet said.
That's
what the Argentinian general said. The second argument they make in these memos is not only is he exempt, but even if he's not exempt, that they give a view of torture that is so cramped and so narrow that it essentially allows torture. They say that torture is only the equivalent of when you're having organ failure in a hospital and you're dying, and that's the only kind of thing that really constitutes torture. That beating the heck out of somebody essentially is not the equivalent of organ failure, and therefore it's not torture.
Or giving drugs, Michael. It's very important to point out that a lot of your clients claim that they were shot up with things they had no idea what it was, and then they don't remember.
Yeah, we do describe in the book what they call IRF squads, which are emergency response.
Immediate
response forces that go and they beat the heck out of people if they're for minor infractions or to give them injections
or
otherwise.
Hold people down and shoot them up with something.
I mean, Guantanamo turned out to be much worse than I anticipated. I always thought that in Bagram in Afghanistan, yes, torture was going on, and certainly after Abu Ghraib, Iraq. But I never really suspected the level of abuse and torture that I think is occurring in Guantanamo.
Are there places other than Guantanamo where people are snatched up by the American forces and being held?
All over the world.
The U.S. is running an international center of detention, torture camps all over the world. There's Guantanamo, there's Bagram, obviously, there's Iraq, and then there's, for all we know, Diego Garcia, and there's secret facilities
in
other places.
And then there are lots of ships that prisoners are taken on to.
Where we don't know what's happening on those, although we have heard stories that people are beaten on ships.
As a result of the recent Supreme Court decision on Guantanamo, is there any chance that lawyers like yourself, Michael, be able to find out more about these prison camps?
Well, one of the things we're doing is at least we're trying to get lawyers down to Guantanamo immediately after the Supreme Court decision. We think that decision means that lawyers should be authorized to visit Guantanamo. But the other secret detention camps are going to be hard to get at. Of course, there's another practice which has been talked about, which is not just our own camps, but sending people to be tortured in other countries in a process called rendering. The Center for Constitutional Rights represents Mahar Arar, who has been rendered to Syria, where he was tortured, and then we eventually
handing,
got him out.
Handing him over to a country that the U.S. knows can torture and not have any press about it.
Right, where they can just give him to Jordan and say, or give him to Morocco or Egypt, or say, you know, torture him, get the information for us. We don't want to dirty our own hands.
One of your clients, it's a big case now in Australia because he was sent to Egypt and tortured.
Right. Habib, who's one of our clients who was in the Supreme Court, is in Guantanamo. He was picked up in Afghanistan or Pakistan, I'm not sure which.
Put in the back of a truck, too, or in the trunk.
Right. And then eventually taken to Egypt for 3 weeks, where we believe he was tortured, and then taken to Guantanamo, where he is not in such good shape.
Let's tell readers where they could get a copy of this book. It looks very readable. It's not a, you know, overwhelmingly legalized publication. And it's published by Chelsea Green Publishing. It's out in bookstores now?
Yes, it's there now, or within the next, well, yeah, by Friday. Yes, the book is there now. You can get it, obviously, on BarnesandNoble.com, Amazon.com, probably most of the major bookstores within the next few days.
And the timing of the release is quite close to the Supreme Court case, so I imagine that will help draw attention to it.
Well, I hope so, because it's called What the World Should Know, because really in working with Guantanamo for 2.5 years, I've been incredibly outraged, but not as outraged as I think much of the rest of the world has been, and people in the United States just don't get it. Mm. When I talk to Muslim people around the world, for them, Guantanamo is iconic of everything the United States is doing wrong in the world, and the Arab world in particular, and the Muslim world. And they talked to me about the image of a Marine in camouflage and crew cuts standing over kneeling, bent down, hooded, shackled Muslims as being really the image the U.S. is projecting around the world. So it's an important book to get out. It's an important message to get out to the people that this is what the United States is doing to people.
Thank you both for writing this important book.
And thanks for being on the show.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Titan and Khaki began to buy up companies that had pre-existing government contracts. So after they had bought up all of this capacity and began to enter into contracts with the government, in order to ensure that they were perceived as effective interrogators, they entered into a conspiracy with certain U.S. government officials. And the conspiracy is one in which they decided to ignore and violate the host of international and domestic laws that constrain the manner in which you are permitted to interrogate people. In order to meet quotas and to constantly crank out more information from the detainees, they simply violated their human rights.
We just heard an excerpt from the Center for Constitutional Rights press conference announcing the filing of the lawsuit against two United States corporations, Titan and Khaki. That was Susan Burke, cooperating attorney on the case. We're pleased to have her as a guest on Law and Disorder.
Susan Burke, this is Michael Smith at Law and Disorder. I understand that along with the Center for Constitutional Rights, your law firm is engaged in two lawsuits against two corporations, the Titan and the Khaki Corporation, involving torture in Iraq.
That's right. It's actually a single lawsuit in which we're seeking a class action status on behalf of all folks in Iraq who were imprisoned and tortured.
Can you tell me what, in a nutshell, what's at stake here in the lawsuit?
Well, what we're really seeking is to get some kind of monetary remedy for the folks that were tortured and abused by these government contractors. What we've alleged is that the company employees were working in a conspiracy with government officials, and they, you know, seriously harmed these people.
Can you tell us what these people have said was done to them?
Well, there's really just a terrible array of things. One gentleman was forced. He and his father were imprisoned for no charge. These are people that are just picked up. They're not told what they are being charged with. They were thrown in prison, and then they were beat up. They were shocked with electric prods. There's some terrible kind of sexual things that went on. And in one of our cases, one of our clients, not only did all of this happen to him, but he was forced to witness all of these same terrible procedures being done to his father, and his father then died. So those are, you know, that's just a snippet of the kind of things that people were forced to live through.
I'm curious about the role of the corporations. Can you give a little background on how long this kind of thing has been going on?
Well, what we've really seen is an increasing use by the United States government of outside contractors to perform functions that used to be within the purview of the military. So they essentially outsourced the intelligence interrogations. And as we've been able to piece together both from records, public records, such as the Taguba report and the Red Cross reports, as well as from testimony from our clients, that there were teams of people that would work together. They would include, at times they would include people in uniform, but then there would also be people in civilian clothing. And the teams tended to have an interrogator, a translator, and so the two different companies, Khaki and Titan, had thousands of people over in Iraq working in these various capacities, working as interrogators, working as translators.
And what kind of training did these people have? Is that anything that's brought up in your lawsuit?
Yes, actually, one of the allegations we make is that the corporations did not take due care in how they hired and trained the folks that they sent over there. And in fact, there are some documents up on the web where the companies are touting to potential employees that they will be working with minimal supervision.
Is this attributable just a couple of rogue people in a corporation, or does this go all the way up to Lyon, to Cheney and Bush?
Well, our lawsuit is really focusing on the corporate actors, and there we're going to have to take discovery to really assess how high up the corporate chain it goes. But I think in terms of how high up the government chain it goes, it's apparent from what's been made public from the White House, the memoranda, and the like, that there was certainly a change in the United States direction. Previously, the government had always said, you know, you cannot torture people. And unfortunately, with some of what we've seen coming out, that seemed to slip.
And you think that was the kind of culture they created that allowed Titan and Khaki to come in there and do what you've described?
Well, we're going to have to see how the companies defend themselves. I mean, one defense, they may step forward and say, well, you know, even though we did these terrible things, we did it because we were directed to do so by the government. Now, it'll be a fascinating legal question, but, you know, from our take on it and our research, that does not get them off the hook. You cannot perform illegal acts simply because somebody contracted and paid for you to do so. Through my contacts in the human rights community, they suggested that I get in touch with the Center for Constitutional Rights, which had already done such wonderful work in this field. And so I just picked up the phone and called Michael Ratner, and we met, and then we were joined by a third attorney, Sharif Akil, out in Michigan, and that put together our virtual team for this case.
Yeah. Susan, let me ask you this. What happens if you're successful in this lawsuit? Are these corporations going to stop their involvement in interrogations and so forth?
Well, there's if the people, the corporate employees, are properly trained and understand where the limits are, then there's not a desire to, you know, to just stop outsourcing in general. I mean, that's not our aim. Our aim is to make sure that people's human rights aren't violated.
Right.
And so, you know, you can envision a situation in which anyone sent over there is trained on the Geneva Convention, trained on all the different laws that protect people, and they're, you know, they're taught to conduct interrogations in compliance with that.
Yeah.
Well, we wish you every success and a big payday at the end of this, because I think if you do that in Titan and Khaki, there's going to be some heads rolling.
Well, thank you so
much.
Thank
you, Susan.
Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you.
You've just heard from Susan Burke, a Philadelphia attorney with the law firm Montgomery, McCracken, Walker & Rhodes, about the recently filed cases with the Center for Constitutional Rights against U.S. corporations Titan and Khaki.
Right now, we will be hearing about a recent Supreme Court case decided on June 29th that opened the doors of American courts to suing foreigners and foreign corporations for international human rights violations ranging from torture to slavery and to other similar kinds of serious violations.
We're going to be talking with Jenny Green, staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Jenny is one of the attorneys who has sued Unocal, Shell, and Chevron for torture and murder in Nigeria under what's known as the Alien Torts Claims Act. Jenny Green, hi. This is Michael Smith on Law and Disorder. We understand you're a staff attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights.
That's correct.
And we also understand that there was a significant victory on the Alien Torts Claims Act a couple weeks ago with the Supreme Court. Can you tell us what the Alien Torts Claims Act is and what the victory means?
Sure. The Alien Tort Claims Act is a statute from 1789 which allows human rights lawsuits in the United States. And since 1980, the Center for Constitutional Rights has successfully brought such claims for torture and other gross human rights violations.
Well, the Alien Tort Claims Act goes all the way back to the founding of the United States, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Its origins are mysterious, but it looks like one of the impetuses was there were incidents between international diplomats, one diplomat beating up another. There were concerns about piracy on the high seas, and this statute was enacted to allow these claims to be resolved in the courts of the United States.
Well, what kind of things happened to the people that you're representing where the defendants didn't want you to be able to use the act now?
The history of the use of the Alien Tort Claims Act started in 1979 when the family of Hoalita Falardiga came to the center. And Hoalita Falardiga was the son of an opposition leader to the then dictator Stroessner in Paraguay. And Hoalita Falardiga was tortured to death by Américo Peña Irala, a police official. A case was brought to the court by Rhonda Copeland, Peter Weiss, two CCR attorneys, who argued that torture was a violation of the law of nations, and thus Hoalita Falardiga, as a foreign citizen, as an alien, could bring a claim for a tort, a wrong against the person, for a violation of the law of nations.
That even though someone is tortured or abused overseas, that you can bring that kind of case in the United States?
Yeah, that's correct.
And it would also seem to me that if you can go to command responsibility, if we were to apply it to things like Abu Ghraib, it could mean that those commanders who were above the people who actually did the torture and who knew or should have known about it could also be brought in under the Alien Tort Claims Act. Is that right?
That's correct.
Jenny, other than the case against the Titan and Khaki for alleged torture over in Iraq, what are the other big cases the center has pending in this area?
Currently, there's also a number of cases pending against multinational corporations. And CCR was the organization that basically made the link between you could get torturers, you could get people in positions of command and control, to get non-governmental actors. That was a case brought against Radovan Karadzic. And moving on from there, you could bring human rights cases against multinational corporations.
So Jenny, I understand that you've had three cases against three oil companies. Can you tell us in a nutshell what you did with Unocal and Shell and Chevron?
Chevron has been sued for violations against activists protesting Chevron's activities in Nigeria. We also have claims pending against the Unocal Corporation for slave labor and other human rights violations committed in connection with the natural gas pipeline project, and claims against Shell Royal Dutch Petroleum.
So you must be encouraged by the recent Supreme Court ruling upholding the Alien Tort Claims Act.
Well, first of all, there were two decisions which came down which were positive about the Alien Tort Claims Act, Rasul and the Alota case, in which the Supreme Court said that the Guantanamo detainees also had a right to bring alien tort claims.
So does that mean that a citizen of a different country tortured outside the United States can come in and use American courts to go after the bad guys?
The argument about bringing these cases is when the defendant is present in the United States, that defendant is subject to the United States laws. If a person comes in who has violated international law, they can be sued here.
Isn't that the situation where my co-host Michael Ratner, when Gramajo was walking across the stage to get an honorary degree, they laid a lawsuit on him?
That's correct.
He was the general in Guatemala who we accused of killing up to 10,000 Conjobol Indians in Guatemala.
We got a judgment for $47 million.
I hope you collect it.
Yeah, they have assets here that can easily be attached.
We at the center, it's Michael Ratner again, that we were utterly and happily surprised by the Supreme Court ruling. I think for a number of years we expected that the Supreme Court would not allow these kind of cases to go forward. It's really a major victory, one that wasn't as noticed as Guantanamo and the other cases. But it really opens the door to the kinds of suits that Jenny has been working on at the center.
Yeah, and thanks for giving attention to it, because the business community is running around, believe it or not, declaring that they won.
And I think one significant point is you've seen the cases go from individual torturers to now major oil companies, really. If you look at our three cases, Unocal, Shell, and Chevron, that's a statement, really, about what's happening in the world and who's really controlling what's happening out there.
It's also a statement to think that these people want to wiggle off the hook for torture.
Thank you, Jenny.
All right, thank you. Bye.
Jenny Green, staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights. We wish her all her luck in collecting a huge judgment against these oil companies.
Our next show is going to be a special on the upcoming Republican National Convention. We'll hear from civil liberties lawyers, activists, and others about what we can expect in late August in New York. And we'll examine trends among law enforcement that have the effect of chilling First Amendment speech. And we'll hear from legal observers in the streets.
Sometimes it's chaotic, depending on the situation.
Conflict developing between the police and the demonstrators.
They may be in a situation where they can shout out to the person being arrested.
That was where I had to shout about getting the names. What are the names?
What's your name? Ryan! 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 Ryan Mutter!
Police with the dirty! 759!
The cops snatched people who fell over in the barricades. One of them was an older man, two younger people. One didn't give his name. Black, yeah.
All that and more on Law and Disorder's next program.
Before we close the program, we want to invite our listening audience to come down to the federal court, 40 Center Street in Foley Square, 9 o'clock for the Lynn Stewart trial. Extremely important case involving the right of American citizens and others to an attorney unobstructed by a government that videotapes meetings with the attorney and the client, that audiotapes, that gags attorneys. Stewart stood up. She's in the dock now for vigorously defending her client. She needs your help. We invite you to come down Monday through Thursday, Federal Court, 40 Center Street, in the ceremonial courtroom, which some of us call the show trial courtroom.
We at Law and Disorder thank you so much for joining us today. I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Michael Ratner, President of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
And I'm Michael Stephen Smith, New York City attorney and author.